Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday the 11th of May, it's raining and this is Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop, brought to you by the Construction Index. And my preoccupation with the weather, Phil, is simply because it's been absolutely pissing down here today and I think it's going to be raining all over the country. So, we haven't had any rain for a while and I suppose a garden needs it, but I'm glad I'm indoors.
Well, good for the garden, and I don't have to be out doing anything either, so happy to see a bit of rain occasionally.
So we've got a few things to discuss.
We have.
This week, after almost two weeks silence. So there was quite a big speech delivered this week. Not by the person who was supposed to be delivering it, though, of course.
No.
You know what I'm talking about.
I do, of course I do. Morning, David. Hello. It was the Queen's speech on Tuesday morning this week, the annual opening of Parliament, where she traditionally reads out a list of stuff that the Prime Minister has given to her and says, this is what we're going to be doing. And, of course, she's 96, you know.
Yes.
And a bit wobbly. And so Prince of Wales sat in her place with the... I didn't watch it, but I saw the photos in the paper showing the crown, her crown, sitting next to him. He hasn't, not entitled to have quite yet. But the whole Queen's speech, there's an awful lot of legislation. I can't remember the number, 30 approximately, something like that. I can't remember, but lots and lots of bits of legislation. So it seems like a government with, you know, big agenda. But you go through it and there's not really a lot of beef there. And papers from both wings of the political spectrum, both the Guardian and the Telegraph, kind of went, is that it? It's kind of how I feel, is that, you know, a lot of topics, but not a lot of beef, not a lot of substance within it.
Well, I think I certainly noticed that. I mean, apart from the fact that these days, you know, when there's a budget or a Queen's speech or something like that, it's always trailed, isn't it? It's leaked now. We know basically what's going to be said. It's really just the only thing we don't really know is how it's going to be couched and, you know, what the detail is.
It's not even leaked, though. And a lot of time we do know, or we think we know the detail, because the normal run-of-the-mill with proper big legislator. Well, they have a green paper, then a white paper.
Yeah.
And then
they
say, okay, we'll bring forward the intellectual. So you know that when there's been this, you know, so there's certain legislation that we're absolutely, you know, are expecting. And what becomes newsworthy is when it doesn't turn up, like there's no employment bill, sort of putting right to flexible working into the statute book.
Yeah.
You can imagine that Rees-Mogg and Co. are kind of, oh, can't have flexible working. Brr, don't want that. So that's been, I don't know if it's been dumped or just stuck in the back burner or they're still fighting about what might be in an employment bill. There's not much in the way of planning reform. There's not much in the way of net zero. I mean, they're bits and pieces, but the whole, Robert Jenrick's old planning idea of having three zones, you know, build anything you like here, let's talk about it in this zone and stay away from this zone, roughly speaking, that idea is gone. And I think a lot of the planning kickback goes back to the Chesham and Amersham. There was a by-election, which is a rock-solid blue seat, which the Liberal Democrats, I was going to say, stole. That's putting it unfairly, but they
won fair and square.
What I meant is that they came up the outside, it's meant to be a safe, rock-solid, safe Tory seat, and they lost it, and it was deemed to be. Planning was a big part of it, and house building in all over the, you know, beautiful parts of the country.
It's a very sensitive topic with Tories, isn't it? This sort of thing.
But I think anyone who owns their own home and has worked hard to get it, and it's perhaps, you know, maybe even their third home where they've climbed the ladder and got their dream home, and suddenly find that they're, you know, it's not quite as an exclusive an enclave as they thought they'd invested into. You know, it's their private castle. So I get it. And it's not just the building you know, that might be next door to your building. It's that it could be the other side of town. But if your local town becomes clogged with traffic and there's no new public transport or road system or improvements like that, you know, your 20-minute journey to work can suddenly be an hour journey to work in the space of a bit of house building.
So, that, I mean, the fact that they've sort of basically ditched Genrick's idea is more to do with political expediency, I think, than anything else, because clearly it lost them that by-election, which was a bruising defeat for them. And they very clearly got the message that this was unpopular with an awful lot of voters in their sort of conservative heartland. So that's why that was changed. But getting back to what you said earlier about, you know, being a lot of talk about these popular topics at the moment, and, you know, carbon reduction, levelling up and all the rest of it, all sort of like brave words without much in the way of actual detail. And I noticed that in the absolute deluge, which you always get from industry bodies in response to any government announcement like this, the National Federation of Builders, the NFB, their boss, Richard Beresford, I thought put it very well. He said the speech sets out the agenda, but doesn't really identify the complexities about how we're getting there. And I think, if you remember, that's what we said about the Levelling Up white paper earlier in the year. That came out with lots of sort of aspirational statements, but didn't actually explain how they were going to be executed. And I think this is the same. It just seems a bit empty, I think.
Yeah, well, what they've done with planning, and they put the planning aspects into this Levelling Up bill. What's it actually called? It's called the Levelling Up and Regeneration
and
Bill.
And regenerate, yeah.
And we've talked about before how Levelling Up seems to be the new incarnation of what used to be called inner cities, even though it's not just inner cities, but urban regeneration and that sort of thing. You know, all the old industries which left northern cities on the verge of collapse when the industries collapsed. You know, I'm thinking of mining and shipbuilding and things.
Yeah.
You know, the creation of urban regeneration, urban development corporations, forgive me, was a clear strategy and wasn't universally, you know, overwhelmingly successful, but by and large was a clear political policy that clearly worked, I think.
Yes.
And it seems to me what they're doing in the bill that's now being proposed is that they're basically pushing it back to local authorities. They're saying, okay, you can have a mayor if you want a mayor. Local authorities can come together and form these sort of county areas or whatever if they want to do that. And decision-making is going to be up to, you know, local people can vote if they want to change the name of their street or if they want, you know, a house in the street to have an extension. So they're sort of pushing it back and saying, you know, power to the people. And it's quite seductive, the sort of the idea of devolution and putting power back to the local authority, but it doesn't really help a government deliver on its agenda if it's simply passing responsibility for delivering its aspirations back to local authorities and local mayors.
Yes, especially if they're talking about levelling up, because that has to, you have to take the broader view. You can't really sort of say to people up in Leeds, level up your area, would you please? It has to be done by central government. It has to be a national policy, not just a regional one.
Well, they're giving Leeds, to use that example. I don't know exactly the detail of what the legislation will say, but essentially it's giving the local authorities, is the theory, more powers to do what they need to do. And saying, so you get, as you say, you get on and do it. Your job, your fault if it fails.
Yeah.
It seems to me.
And where's the money coming from for that? I mean,
well, one of the things we do know is in the briefing notes which the government put out about how the new power that local authorities will have. They will be able to confiscate, basically, seize any shops which have been shut and empty for, is it more than a year? Is it specific about that?
I don't know how long it is, but yeah. But
if they've been empty for a certain period of time, the local authority will be able to say, right, we're taking that off you and we're putting it up for auction in the hope that some other developer who wants to turn up, you know, an old Woolworths, if there are any Woolworths still lying empty, or whatever the other shops that have more recently closed down are.
Pick one, you know, there's plenty out there.
There are. But I was going to say one, I thought, oh, has that gone? I might get in trouble for suggesting that something's gone when it hasn't. But yes, there are plenty of empty department stores and big shops, and a lot of them being turned into, as we know, into homes, flats. Some of them have been turned into like roller parks and leisure centres and bouncy castle places and all sorts of imaginative ways of filling empty shops. But even that's not gone down universally well. It sounds uncontroversial.
Yeah.
But here's the local government association. Empowering councils to bring vacant properties back into use is an encouraging step. National permitted development rights allowing conversion of offices, shops and restaurants into houses without the need to provide any affordable homes or infrastructure funding.
I noticed that the British Property Federation dismissed this idea of rent auctions as a gimmick. They're clearly not convinced about that. I mean, there's definitely a problem in town centres, city centres, and just high streets generally because of the change in retail patterns. I mean, we've got a feature in the magazine, which current issue of the magazine, which is about how this is changing, how the sort of landscape of the high street is changing because, you know, people are tending to buy stuff online rather than go and actually buy it in person. And the cost of, you know, renting property on the high street is just ridiculously high. So there is a problem there which needs to be solved.
But I'm not sure that auctioning off empty stores, as good a thing as it is actually going to lead to the levelling up of the nation and reduce inequality and reduce. It might reduce a bit of crime, I suppose, a bit of vandalism, but I don't think it will increase life expectancy and all these other grand aspirations
that
the levelling up paper. White paper set out.
Yeah.
But should we run through a couple of the other bits of legislation and see what...
Yes, by all means, yeah.
Depends where you stand on HS2, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, but it's a nuts and bolts one, is the high-speed rail brackets crew to Manchester bill, which is just the enabling legislation to build the final bit of the HS2, the line, the last bit up to Manchester. That is what it is and familiar. We've got another modern slavery bill, which is kind of interesting. We had the Modern Slavery Act of 2015, which requires, you know, businesses to not employ slaves. I thought that it had been illegal since 18 something, actually. But this new 2022 slavery bill, it rather suggests that it's almost like, I think the Modern Slavery Act 2015, Theresa May was Home Secretary, and I think it's very much her her baby. And this is almost Boris Johnson or Priti Patel, who's now the Home Secretary, sort of saying, ugh, that Theresa May, she didn't know what she was doing. We're going to do it properly. And it's sort of thumbing their nose. I'm sure there's none of that, but there seems to be some sort of sense that it needs tightening up because there is still plenty of evidence of modern slavery around in the UK at the moment.
Yeah.
But the solution, as far as I can see, is that big companies who do more than £36 million a year of business, are going to have to add another boilerplate statement to their annual reports.
Yes.
We're against it, and we, you know, we don't do it, and this, that, and the other. And for all this talk of we're going to cut back on red tape, the Conservative governments of the past however many years seem terribly keen on putting new laws and onuses on companies to say that they're not going to do this and we don't do that. And whether it's green things or slavery things or gender pay gaps and things like that. Mm-hmm. There's an awful lot of this corporate governance stuff, which they have to do because government says you've now got to do that. And okay, some they invest in it and go to town on it and make it a big sales, you know, part of their sales pitch. And others, it's just quite simply you go to the local trade association and say, can you give us the wording for this, and we'll, you know, we'll cut and paste it onto our website or whatever. And it, I don't know, is business any more ethical today than it was 30 years ago?
Well, this is it. I mean, as you know, the anti-slavery commissioner, Dame Sarah Thornton, last week published a report, which is actually compiled by a former colleague of ours, Emma Crates, looking at a particular case and using this as a case study of modern slavery and how it should be tackled and how it's still prevalent. But a lot of these, you know, these companies already say, so a lot of them already say that we don't, you know, we have methods of weeding out abuses such as modern slavery. And they, and, you know, it's their part of their mission statement. And yet the case that was focused on in this report actually deals with companies who at the time said that they were squeaky clean. Basically, they were saying we don't employ slaves and we have nothing to do with it. There are no slaves.
But they were hoodwinked.
They were hoodwinked. They were. But how could? But they seemed confident enough to be able to go on the record to say that they had robust methods for avoiding the exploitation of trafficked people. When in actual fact, that's exactly what was happening.
It seems to me what we need is an employment bill which goes further to encourage and promote the direct employment of certainly in construction of the labour force. If people are directly employed, you've got much greater confidence that when you pay their paycheck, I would imagine, it's going into their personal bank account rather than into some gangmaster's bank account. I mean, maybe the aspects of the modern slavery bill that are in this 2022 legislation were going to be or could have been part of the mooted employment bill, which is all about workers' rights and so on.
Yeah, yes.
Which didn't come forward. So I don't know.
I don't know either. I mean, in the summary of the Queen's speech here, it talks about, you know, the main elements of the bill include things like strengthening the operation of slavery and trafficking prevention orders and slavery and trafficking risk orders, which place conditions on an individual to prevent and disrupt modern slavery, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which is fine. But again, we're back to this business of where's the beef? You know, how are they going to strengthen the operation of these orders? How are they going to change? There's no substance behind the intention there.
But even if there is, it's not for the good guys. For most people, it doesn't change anything. It's saying here's something that's against the law. People are still getting away with it. We're going to make it harder for them to get away with it, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
But it's not going to. I don't think it's going to make a great deal of difference to the construction industry.
No, probably not.
It makes a great deal of difference to the people who are being exploited. I'm not doing that down, but I don't think it's transformative for the industry as a whole.
No, I don't. I suppose the construction industry, above all others, really, is the one industry that probably is likely to have the biggest problem with human exploitation because of the sort of transitory nature of a lot of site work and the fact that, you've got a lot of casual labour involved, people who are... It's always been a problem with construction, of course, that there's a relatively low proportion of directly employed people working on site. And so you've got that lack of clarity and the ability for abuse to be... to go unnoticed.
Agriculture as well.
And agriculture is another
seasonal
one,
fruit pickers or vegetable pickers or whatever they're picking. Similar sort of scenario.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's modern slavery. I just wanted to run through a couple of the other things. The UK Infrastructure Bank Bill.
Yes.
The Infrastructure Bank could be transformative. I mean, the bank already exists.
Yes, exactly.
It's set up. I can't remember the name of the chap who's in charge of it, but it exists. But this is enshrining its objectives and functions into law and sets some of the rules and further detail. So I think that's good and new and important. But I think we've already had the change with the creation of the bank, I think.
Yes.
So I can't get terribly excited about that.
Just making it official. No, not at all.
And then we've got the Energy Security Bill, which... You would think this ought to be the headline piece of legislation, given what's happening with energy prices and the energy crisis we're going through and everything's happening. This should be the real, election winner. But what I read into it, there's going to be a hydrogen heating trial, which apparently you need legislation for. I don't understand why you need legislation for that. And it's going to put the heat network sector under the powers of the Ofgem regulatory regime. Didn't know it wasn't. I'm sure it's important, but I'm not going to suddenly change my vote because Ofgem have now got heat networks under their watch. And the extension of the price cap beyond 2023. Well, the Tories were all against the extension of the price cap when Labour Party were proposing it. And they said, oh, we better do it then. So it's someone else's policy they've stolen. They don't want to be doing it. They've got no choice but to do it with the way things are. So it's a very reluctant extension of the price cap. Not much indication of what happens after 2023.
No, exactly.
Anything else caught your eye in the Queen's speech, David?
Well, it was, there was the procurement bill.
Oh, yes.
Which is about taking, again, it's about taking back control. The fact that, you know, obviously we, public sector procurement before Brexit was governed by EU regulations, and of course those no longer apply. So the government says that now we can take back control of our public sector procurement, make it easier for small to medium-sized enterprises to bid for public sector contracts, and also giving public sector bodies more autonomy, more control over their procurement processes, which sounds good. I mean, I don't know whether or not that lack of sort of central oversight, well, I suppose there will be some oversight, but the fact that you're sort of devolving the procurement process to public sector bodies, I just wonder if that will create space for, I don't know, abuse or just incompetence, and will actually make procurement less effective or less efficient.
Well, I'm going to place on record that public sector procurement, by and large, certainly from central government, is in a bigger state of mess than it has ever been. Whether it's the going back to the IT scandal in the NHS, defence procurement is an absolute scandal.
Yes,
what the Scots can't even buy a ferry. I mean, it's just thing after thing. When the post office procured a new IT system, they ended up deciding to put half their managers, post office, what are they called? Postmasters.
Yeah, in prison.
In prison, rather than admit that they made a mistake with their IT. It's absolutely appalling. And we have an organisation called the Chartered Institute of Purchasing and Supply, and I don't know what it should lose its charter, frankly. I don't know what that organisation thinks it's doing. And procurement is a mess. So giving public sector procurers more freedom, well, maybe it's a mess because they're all tied down by rules and regulations which they can't follow. And maybe a little bit of freedom to engage common sense might be a good thing.
Yeah.
But I don't think so.
No, I don't think so. I just think that it's like, it's almost as if the government is saying, we can't handle this, so you'll have to sort it out for yourselves. I don't know. I agree that potentially if you put the power into the hands of those people who are actually procuring the goods and services, maybe that will focus their attention on making sure that they do it correctly and get what they need. But on the other hand, you've got to make sure that the people making those decisions are competent, are qualified to do so. And I'm not convinced that they necessarily are. It sounds again as if the government is deciding to do something without thinking it through.
It sounds like it could be good, but let's see whether it works.
I don't think there's anything else in the Queen's speech. I mean, I obviously didn't listen to the Queen's speech. I never do listen to the Queen's speech because my mind tends to wander and I forget what's being said. I usually pick up on the reports of it later. Nothing else that's really caught my attention apart from the topics we've discussed.
To be honest, if you have listened to the last half hour of us talking, you probably have heard more than you heard in the Queen's speech, because the actual Queen's speech is just a list of headlines. The information that you need, and if you do want to know more about renters reform or the harbour's seafarers remuneration bill or the genetic technology precision breeding bill or the non-domestic rate, all these other bits of legislation, the place to go is gov.uk website, and then find the bit where it says consultation and papers, and there's a PDF that you can call up under the consultation and papers of the same date as whatever Tuesday was, the 10th of May. And that's a 140-page document which gives you, I mean, whatever beef is there, by which I mean meat rather than argument, is there, exists, is all in that document. So you can have a look at that.
Yeah.
Should we move on to, should we change the subject?
Yeah, let's do that.
I'd like to talk about Jeremy Pilkington. Do you know Jeremy Pilkington?
I do. I met him once, long, long time ago.
Did you? I never have, but I feel like I should have. When did you? When and how did you meet him? Who is he?
Well,
tell people who he is.
Well, he is the chairman of VP PLC, which a specialist. You can't really can you call them a plant hire these days? It was used to be Vibroplant, and as the original name suggests, they had a specialization in vibratory rollers and general plant as well, sort of
hiring it out rather than making
plant.
It.
Yeah, exactly. So Vibroplant. It started a lot longer ago than I'd realised. I think back in the 50s, wasn't it? Jeremy Pilkington's father launched the business.
1954.
Yeah. But it is a stalwart of the UK plant hire industry. And it's interesting because it has a very specific character, the way it's structured and the way it covers a lot of ground, almost literally, in fact, but with specialist divisions. Vibroplant used to be very much sort of general plant, rollers, dumpers, that kind of thing. And then it relaunched itself as VP PLC, and I can't remember when that happened, but I think it was about 20 years ago, something like that.
2001, yeah, it fledged on the stock exchange.
Okay, yeah.
As Vibroplant in 73, and in 2001, it relaunched as VP.
That's right.
It's a bit of a horrid name, actually, because it's sort of, you know, big V, little P, gets lost, and
yeah.
Vibroplant's a much better brand, but it didn't really reflect what they now were.
No, that's right. And Jeremy Pilkington has been, I wouldn't say a very high-profile boss, but he has been there, because he took over from his father when his father died very suddenly back in the late 70s. Took over the business and ran it, and has
in his 20s.
Yeah, in his 20s, and he's I think, as you pointed out, he's just turned 71 and has decided he's had enough. I don't know whether or not that's a fair assessment, but he, you know, I don't know whether or not his age is purely coincidental, but he and his board have decided that they want to sell the business. I mean, they've built it up into a very successful business. It's one of the biggest plant hire groups in the UK. And it's got lots of interesting subdivisions and even companies within those subdivisions. Ground Force, very well known organization. UK Forks, which is
telehandler hire.
Yeah, telehandler hire, very specialized. Brandon Hire Station, which used to be, you know, Brandon Hire was an independent tool hire company. So they've got that. Torrent Trackside, which specializes in hiring out specialized rail plant and other things like this. TPA and ESS, I have to confess, I don't know what they do.
TPA, I know. They're those temporary tracks, for whether it's sporting events or festivals or whatever, but more often rain construction. It's roadways to access, if you're putting up a wind turbine across a muddy field or something, you need to drive your vehicles across a temporary. It's like a Bailey Bridge that doesn't bridge anything.
That's right, yeah. And it's interesting because they've got all these divisions, a lot of them, if not all of them, actually, built up through acquisition rather than businesses which Pilkington has launched himself. Take Ground Force, for instance. They're well known for their trench support systems and these big hydraulic props for massive
excavations,
and they always put out excellent photographs which find their way into the magazine. You'll often see them in the magazine simply because their photography is so good, although I have to say a lot of the projects which they work on are fascinating. But I mean,
Ground Force are a case study, quick tangent, as you make the point that Ground Force are a case study in good PR, that if you employ a decent photographer rather than just stick your smartphone in the air but get a proper photographer and perhaps even a drone or something, it is worth its weight. You'll get so much press coverage if you can get decent photos out there rather than just relying on pictures snapped through a barbed wire fence.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's they say a picture is worth 1,000 words, and that's is very often true.
I think about 1,500 these days.
But, I mean, within Ground Force, that just that one division, they've got a little specialist niches, which is fascinating. Piletech, they make things like or is it Mr. Cropper? Forgive me if I've got the name of the company wrong, but they do, you know, they pile cropping equipment and stuff like that. Stopper specialists with these inflatable bungs for stopping up pipes and stuff like that while you're working on them. And U-Mole, a trenchless technology firm. All these little businesses within the divisions which make up the group themselves. So they've got this broad range of coverage within the industry, each of which is a specialist in its area. And I think that's, it's an interesting way of structuring your business, but it clearly works because, as I say, VP PLC is a very successful business. But they've decided, for reasons known only to them at the moment, that they want to find a buyer.
Well, it's not so much them. It's Jeremy Pilkington himself. I mean, VP is listed on the stock exchange, but Jeremy Pilkington owns 51 point something percent of it, or 50 point something, roughly 51% of it. And he wants out. And I'm not sure exactly whether... So he said to the board, I say he owns it via some other holding company, which basically he owns, family interests and so on. And he said, went to the board and said, I want out. And between him and the board, they agreed that, OK, we need to find a buyer for the company. Let's get, you know, advisors in to find us a buyer. And I think that means it's going to be 100% sale. They're not. It's not just 51% sale. But I don't know how that works with regard to the 49% of the shares that are, you know, owned on the stock exchange.
I was wondering what the options are. I mean, an outright purchase, or I thought maybe a management buy-in might be on the cards, or even, and we've talked about this a lot, employee ownership. I thought that might be an option.
I think if they're going for employee ownership or management buyout, they would have come out instead of saying Jeremy Pilkington wants his money out and therefore we're selling the business, they would have come out and said Jeremy Pilkington wants his money out and therefore we've agreed a management buyout and therefore we're setting up an employee buyout. I think that would have all been one move. What they've done basically is put a bid for sale to see what offers they get. If they get no offers, you know, they may very well have to start looking in that direction.
Well, exactly, yeah. I don't know. It'd be interesting to see. I mean, have you got any theories yourself, Phil, about what might happen?
I have two. I mean, the usual suspects are venture capitalists who want to buy it, you know, fatten it up, strip it, turn it around and get out. I hope that doesn't happen.
I hope they don't do that. Yeah, me too, yeah.
I think there's one prime suspect out there, and that would be Altrad. The French company, Altrad, Mourad Altrad is this very, very, very interesting Frenchman whose biography says he was born sometime around maybe 1948, we think.
Isn't he a Bedouin or something like that?
Born in a nomadic tribe in Syria, orphaned at an early age.
Right.
I mean, he's the ultimate self-made man. And the name Altrad is now on the French rugby shirts. Is it on the French football shirts as well? He owns.
Oh yes.
He owns Montpellier Rugby Club. He sponsors the All Blacks. I mean, he's been spoken of as a potential president of France at some point. I think is he the mayor of Montpellier? I'm not sure about that, but he's got a political profile.
Idea.
Fabulously rich. Owns, you know, all the own business. He's the man. I mean, he bought. What was the scaffolding company he bought? Actavo, which used to be Debra Services, he bought.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
But he bought, most recently, RMD Quickform last year from Interserve. And I think RMD Quickform would be a really, really good fit, as would Altrad's interest, other interests in the UK, would be a really good fit with VP. And I think VP is a company that's culturally used to having one person with a majority ownership. You know, Jeremy Pilkington, I mean, yes, it's got good solid management and he doesn't do all the work, or it's not sort of, you know, anything like that, as far as I understand it. But I just think if it emerged that Altrad was going to buy VP, I would not be surprised, and I would say, told you so.
Are you confident enough to put money on that, Phil?
What odds are you going to give me?
I have no idea. I'm not a betting man myself.
If I was forming a book, I would put some form of private equity buyout as the favourite, probably evens. But I'd you know, I'd take 3-1 for Mohamed Al Tayed buying it.
Right.
Let's face it, there aren't that many buyers out there. As we saw when IMD Quickform came up for sale, I'd thought there'd be, you know, many more people wanting a slice of that. So, yeah, I don't know. Who do you think? What do you reckon?
Well, I thought of Sunbelt because, of course, they're the biggest. But then I thought there might be monopoly problems there. And also, their business is a little bit more like what Vibroplant was before it became VP.
They're more bear hire, I think. You know, tool hire type of model rather than services. They do have services as well, Sunbelt.
Yeah. No, apart from them, can't really think of anybody. As you said, I think a private equity sale would be a shame because I think it needs... Well, in fact, they said Neil Stothard, the CEO of the company, put out a statement saying they're looking for a buyer who will... Oh, I can't remember exactly what the words were, but they would, you know, respect the heritage of the business and its... is basically its business aspirations going forward. So they want somebody who is going to not invest just money in the business, but also, you know, commitment to build it up and continue, I suppose, sort of retain its culture, you know, the company culture. And I don't think that a private equity firm is the right person to do that or the right buyer to do that. So I'm intrigued by the Al Tayed idea because I can certainly see a synergy there.
And his whole business has been made up of the type of acquisitions that Pilkington has done. I mean, started off, I think, selling or making wheelbarrows and has gone from there. You know, each little bit of has added on from wheelbarrows.
Yeah, right. Well, we'll have to keep our eyes peeled and see what happens.
But you say you met Jeremy Pilkington. What were the circumstances?
Oh, many years ago when I was working on Construction News. I can't remember. I went up to Harrogate, I think is where they're headquartered, and met him there and interviewed him. I don't know whether or not it was simply because I wanted to find out what the business is all about. This is when Vibroplant was still Vibroplant. So it would have been in the sort of early to mid-90s. He struck me as a really nice chap, actually. Just, you know, not especially full of himself or anything like that. I tell you who he reminded me of, and I don't know why, because somebody will... I'm sure a lot of people will say why, but I came away, he reminded me of Jonathan Dimbleby. I think it's just his manner. There's just the way he spoke. And I don't know, it's strange, isn't it? You get an opinion of somebody and it just sticks with you. I mean, he's probably nothing like Jonathan Dimbleby, but that's the impression I came away with.
It's often how we remember people than me, whether it's in a work setting or not. If you think, you know, the impression that they make is compared to, you know, someone else. Same way if we read a book and I don't know if you do, but if I read a book, I'll be thinking, ooh, I wonder who I'd cast to play this part in the film.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, it's just the way your mind works. I mean, I'm sure that I'm very reliable when it comes to things like that because I can remember thinking that there was a strong familial resemblance between the newsreader Selina Scott and Bob Geldof. And when I mentioned this to my wife, she said, "You must be blind." I said, "No, they could be brother and sister." No, apparently not. But so that's just me, folks.
I think they're easier to tell apart because one owns the comb.
Exactly. Yeah, and I'm sure there are other differences as well. But yeah, so Jeremy Pilkington, I think, is he's not your typical plant hire. I'd say that.
Well, he's certainly put a shift in, hasn't he? 50-something years in the job.
Well, yeah, not half. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Actually, tell a lie, not quite 50 years, 40-something years in the job, but yeah.
Yes, yeah. So, I mean, he deserves a break. And when you consider, I don't know whether or not it was always on the cards that he would take over the business from his father or whether the fact that his father's sort of untimely demise sort of catapulted him into the position. I don't know. I mean, I know other people in business who have certainly done that. One chap, I'm not going to name him.
But he's called Bert.
he's the boss, the owner of a materials manufacturing firm, which is very successful. It was a family business making fairly uninspiring construction products. The eldest son of the company owner, very bright, went to private school, went on to Oxford, got a good degree, and ended up in the city working for one of the big accountancy firms, and was extremely capable and successful. I mean, in his 20s, he was going off rescuing businesses on the continent. Then his father died unexpectedly, and he gave up everything and went back up north to rescue the family business, because, of course, by now he had a lot of experience under his belt. And instead of just rescuing the business and selling it off to somebody else, or handing it over to the management, he stayed and built the business up. It's interesting. It's a sort of
I'm going to cast Michael J. Fox in that part.
All right, okay. Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, we're going off on a tangent here, but actually I got an email from somebody just yesterday, in fact, saying, because Father's Day apparently is coming up. I don't know if you knew about that. I completely ignore it, as do my children. But there's somebody trying to pitch an interview or a features idea to me, saying it's Father's Day coming up. And I wondered if you'd be interested in speaking to my client who took over his business from his father. This is somebody else, somebody that I've never met or heard of before. I just thought it was rather a weak peg to hang a story on, the fact that it's Father's Day and he happened to take over the business from his father. But it was, I think there might be more to it than that, because reading between the lines, it sounded as if the father, who again died rather suddenly and unexpectedly, the father had run the business with an iron fist and hadn't allowed his son, who was working for him, to make any executive decisions. And so the company sort of ticked over relatively okay. Then the son found himself in the driving seat and all of a sudden was making all the decisions. And in the 5 years since the takeover, has doubled turnover. I don't know if he's doubled profit as well. But so, you know, with family businesses, small family businesses, there's a
dynamic.
You know, there's a different dynamic there.
I find that absolutely fascinating. And the management of the transfer from one generation to generation. Because it's quite natural, if you've set up a business that you might have started in your 20s and you've spent 50 years building up this business and you want to hand it on to your children or your child. But at the same time, you know that your child could never be as good as you, or you believe that. That for so many people, the natural reluctance to quite know when and how to let go.
Yeah.
And you have to do it.
When's the next series of Succession, Phil?
good point. I don't know. I'm looking forward to it.
Me too. But I mean,
that's exactly what we're talking about. Subject for another. Let's come back to this for subject for another day.
Yeah, let's do
and
that.
Maybe get a warring father and son on to come and argue, and we can play Kathy and Claire, the agony aunts, and there's a reference for people of a certain age. Hands up if you remember Kathy and Claire from your sister's magazine, David.
No, I don't.
I think it's Jackie magazine, but I might have that wrong.
Right, okay. My sister did take that. Yeah, anyway.
I think we've been talking probably too long, but we cannot let this week's podcast go without a very, very loud trumpet voluntary fanfare, 28-gun salute for the announcement that Crossrail is opening.
Yes, amazing.
Or most of it, anyway.
Well, yes, I think the Bond Street station still has a bit of work to do, so they're not going to open that up yet, which will disappoint my daughter, because whose name is Elizabeth, she says, "Dad, they've named a whole tube network after me, the Elizabeth line." She works in Bond Street, so she said, "I'm looking forward to going there." And I had to tell her that actually she's going to have to wait before she can use it. But yes, Crossrail, which was, a great engineering feat and a massive, we've got Tideway now, of course, which is another tunnelling tour de force. But Crossrail really was amazing until it came to the M&E and everything just sort of came unravelled. So it should have been finished how long ago? 5 years ago?
It should have been finished nearly 4 years ago. But guess when?
Right, okay.
Guess when they finished tunnelling?
It was 2015.
2015, they finished tunnelling 7 years, May 2015. Yeah. So you think Crossrail, it's a really big job, it's building a tunnel under London. Yeah. Well, yeah, they started the tunnelling in May 2012, finished it 3 years later. So 3 years tunnelling.
Yeah.
And 7 years putting in the train set.
Yeah, putting in the wiring. This is a thing which I find, because I know that it often happens this way, but I still find it completely baffling why something as complicated and risk-laden as tunnelling under a city like London, which is already full of subterranean tunnels and services, can go relatively smoothly. And yet, when it comes to something like the M&E, the mechanical and electrical systems, which don't have to be done in situ, they could be manufactured, assembled, even tested, I'm sure, remotely, and then simply installed, why that has to be the difficulty? I'm baffled by it. And it's astonishing that it's delayed the whole project by so long. I suppose there's a fitting out as well. But again, I don't think fitting out can be that difficult, can it? Not compared with tunnelling.
I think there was some example of, I remember hearing somewhere, they put the wrong size pipes in and had to strip the pipe work out because when they got to the middle, they found that the left-hand pipe didn't fit with the right-hand pipe, which had started from somewhere else. And there's something like that. There are some, you know, cock-ups, but not 3 years worth. So, yeah.
It is astonishing. I mean, it was... It's funny because everything went quiet when they first announced that Crossway was going to be delayed because of the problems they were encountering. You know, we'd been talking about Crossrail, and everybody had been talking about Crossrail because it was a massive job and very visible. And then everything went completely quiet. And it's almost as if it had become an embarrassment and that you couldn't talk about Crossrail anymore because, it had been such a popular, it had been trumpeted as such a successful project. And all of a sudden it was embarrassing to talk about it now.
Well, it has actually been finished a year, to be honest. It's just not been open to the public because they're so, since they're scared, probably putting it too strongly, but certainly nervous of breaking down and failing and whatever. And I don't know, but they had a year of commissioning and trial running and so on. And I don't know what problems they've had and had to overcome during that year, whether it's been a year of smooth running and they wanted a year of smooth running.
But it is finally opening. It's this month, isn't it? The end of
Tuesday,
this month?
The 24th of May. Yes, I wanted to make that point. Tuesday, the 24th of May, the first proper trains through under London. I mean, there've been some Crossrail out of town, above ground stuff running. But this is the first one where it goes in the big tunnel under London. 12 trains per hour will run between Paddington and Abbey Wood, Monday to Saturday, 6:30 to 2300.
Yeah.
So there'll still be work going on evenings and Sundays, and Bond Street, will open sometime later in the year.
And I think there were some overland stretches which I think are already operating, aren't they? And
yes,
but they've got to sort of try and sort of mesh those into the rest of the line, the Elizabeth line, which is called the Elizabeth line, of course. So I suppose it's a little bit more complicated than perhaps it might sound. It's not simply just one tube and you've open at one end and you come out the other.
No, that's the whole point of Crossrail. It's building a tube to connect overland proper trains. Either side of London, from Essex to Heathrow and that sort of thing. But that's all been linked in. There's nothing to do there. That's all good and going. Good and going.
I'm sure I read in the statement that passengers from, I think, from Heathrow will have to change. They can't just sort of stay on the Elizabeth line. Maybe it's coming into Bond Street and they can't stop there. They have to get off and get onto the central line or something like that. I've no idea. But although it's opening this month, it won't be open 100%. I think that's basically what we're saying, isn't it?
It's going to be... but it'll be running a more than half decent service. Mm. And I'm quite keen to see it. I've seen photos of it and video of what it looks like. But I think there's some quite spectacular architecture involved.
Oh, yeah. Some of the stations are amazing.
Different architects have done different bits and so on.
Yeah.
So I think maybe one or both of us needs to take a little wander around the smoke before too long.
The station I would make a beeline for next time I go to London is Farringdon, because when I first started working in in London. I was working in Clerkenwell, and Farringdon is the closest station to the office. And Farringdon Station...
You would not recognise Farringdon Station today.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad to hear that because it was the most horrible station. It was small and pokey and dirty. Most of it actually was open. It wasn't really underground. I mean, it was the District and Circle line and the Metropolitan line. I can't remember which lines go through there now. But the actual
had Thames Link as well.
Yeah, and the platforms were open. And then I can remember in about in the mid 60s they built a horrible office block over the top of it, really disgusting building. I imagine that's gone now. But it's also, the thing about Farringdon is that it's basically right in the middle of the Crossrail route. It's the sort of, if you like, almost like the centre of it. And there were four tunnel drives converging on Farringdon. And so from a civil engineering point of view, it was incredibly complex. And it was just amazing how they did that. It was a really wonderful, you know, sort of example of tunnelling and civil engineering work. So I'd love to go and visit Farringdon Station again and see how it's transformed.
Right, David, we've been talking for a long time.
Oh, yeah, we won't have any listeners left. They'll all have gone off for their lunch.
Or gently nodding off.
Yes, probably.
To anyone who was listening to us when we were talking about construction A-levels the other week and why there should be some, one or two of you may have thought, well, haven't Bishop and Taylor heard of T-levels?
Yeah.
Which is a fair point. We could have talked about T-levels.
But I'd completely forgotten about them.
Well, yeah. So we'll talk about them another day. We'll see. We'll try and formulate an opinion what we think about T-levels and decide whether they are as good as the A-level that we imagine.
Yeah.
But that's it. David and I will be back again in 2 weeks' time, which will be episode 105 we'll be bringing
Good
you
gracious.
On the 25th of May. Something to look forward to. But for this week, from David and I, thank you very much for listening and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.